Hi everyone, it's Bud. A word of warning before we get to the latest episode of Before the Cheering Started. No, there's no profanity or anything that needs to be bleeped. There was a little bit of extraneous noise at the Mishkin household during this taping. As always, we'll blame the cats. Think of the extra noise as ambiance. Now on with the show. If they call you the Maven, you likely know a thing or two about the subject. That's certainly true for Stan Fischler, the hockey maven. He's worked in the sport for some 70 years, primarily as a writer and broadcaster. He still covers the game in his early 90s, but from a distant perch, a small village in northern Israel where he lives with his son and family. There are hundreds of stories, such as how his love affair with hockey is connected to the movie Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and the most unusual trade ever. I spoke to Stan during his recent visit to New York, and before Iran's April 13th aerial assault on Israel. After covering the sport that you love from afar for so long, what's it like to come here and go to games in person?
It's in many ways like starting all over again. The key here is that I saw my first game at Madison Square Garden in 1939. Well, that would be, compared to today's game, it's like comparing a 1939 Cadillac with a present Cadillac, and the difference is intense, unbelievable in some cases. In 1939, nobody wore a helmet, and no goalie wore a mask, and all the sticks were made of wood and so on. And of course, today, everybody wears a helmet. All the goalies have to wear a mask. And the speed of the game and the style of play is dramatically different. And, you know, when I went to the last few games, actually, I watched a game at Madison Square Garden, and I was out at UBS Arena watching the Islanders. And in a lot of ways, very invigorating because of the changes, because the game is so much faster, and also because the thrill quotient has remained high. That's key. The thrills are there, but they're in a different manner. Different. One exhibit A would be how the goalies play their position. In the old days, the goalies would stand up, they played the angles, and they were worried about getting hit in the face with the puck, and they adjusted accordingly. And nowadays, they flop all over the ice. They can get hit in the mask, right in the face, so to speak, with the puck, and the mask deflects it. They actually use the mask to make saves. So it was fascinating for me to see it up front. I've been watching the games on video back in Israel, and I'm able to see replays and so on. But to be there, and also the fan, the ambiance with the fans is very, very different.
Stan, you've been following the sport or covering the sport from quite afar, for several years now. And that's a reality that most of us will never really understand. What is that like to cover this sport you love and do it from so far away?
Well, the easy answer is I haven't paid for a ticket since 1953. So as a journalist, I've been getting in for nothing. The key to me is whether the game motivates me to write another story. And the fact of the matter is, watching a game, I was watching the Islander game the other night here, not here, but at my friend's house, and they were playing Nashville. And I was yelling and complaining and cheering like I was a 14-year-old. So the fact of staying excited, what I call the IQ, the intensity quotient, has never left me. And that's good and bad. I remember when I was doing Islander games, it's got to be about 20, 25 years ago, I had an intern at the beginning of the season. I said, Joni, this is going to be different this year. I'm going to be much more mature about everything, and I'm not going to get upset, and I'm not going to yell at the referee. And I said, mark my words, it's going to be a new era. And that lasted about, I'd say, about 6 minutes.
That's funny. I had it for about a minute and a half, so you lasted about 4.5 minutes longer than I expected. Yeah. Stan, I remember a time about 25 years ago for me. I was covering a college basketball game at the Garden, and there was a family medical situation going on, and I knew that as of later on that night, I would be pretty much ensconced in that family medical situation. So, but for that afternoon, I covered a college basketball game at the Garden, and it was one of the most enjoyable games I ever covered because I could just lose myself in the game. With what's going on in Israel right now, have you found covering hockey, is it a haven? How would you describe it for you?
Well, certainly mentally it's a haven, and it's pretty parallel to what you experience in the fact that I'm able, if I'm sitting down writing a story, I'm focusing on what I'm writing, or if I got a good lead, and when I finish it, is there a good punchline at the end of the piece? That requires a certain amount of mental fixation on what I'm doing. And that fixation takes me away from the war that's going on around us. And it's a very, very important tonic for me to have this outlet, particularly since there are so many games, and the fact that I write daily. I hardly ever take a day or a night off when I'm not writing. I'm writing for different people also. Writing, my key is a weekly historic piece I do for NHL.com. For example, I just finished one that's going to run when the playoffs begin. And it's about, it's going to be in a couple of weeks, it'll be the 75th anniversary of the first dynasty. And the dynasty is defined by a team that wins three straight Stanley Cups. Well, the first dynasty was, began in the 46-47 season, and it concluded when Toronto won its third straight playoff. That would have been 48-49. So in the spring of 1949, which is 75 years ago, Toronto won the final against Detroit, and that was their third straight cup. And they were the first team. So that's the kind of historic piece that I write every week. And with the playoffs not far away, I'm going to follow. Every week will be a playoff-related story of some kind, some historic piece.
So you must have been pretty happy in the late 40s, because I understand that you grew up not a Rangers fan, but a Toronto Maple Leafs fan. Is this true?
Yeah, the best story I can tell you would be I started rooting for the Maple Leafs in 42 when they won the Cup. But I was bar mitzvahed in April 1945. And I was telling somebody recently that I did my the bar mitzvah. It started 9 in the morning, ended about 12. And then we were going to have a dinner or a lunch. And before I went to the lunch, which was all in the neighborhood of the synagogue, first thing I did was run across the street to the candy store and see who won the Detroit-Toronto playoff game. That was my almost as important as the bar mitzvah was, to run across, find out if the Leafs won, which they did, and then go to my bar mitzvah party.
When you went to your first game at the Garden, and I understand it was for the minor league team, the Rovers, how did that happen? Were your parents hockey fans?
My father was a sports fan, and that particular day was a Sunday, and he had promised me that he would take me to see Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which was the first Walt Disney full-length cartoon type. And it was at the the Globe Theater on Broadway and 45th then. And I was all excited about seeing it, like any kid was. Well, we got off the subway at 50th and 8th Avenue. It was raining. Terrific downpour. We didn't have an umbrella. And we were about 14 steps away from the entrance to Madison Square Garden. And my father realized that there was a hockey doubleheader. In those days, on Sundays, they had a Met League game and then the Rover game, which was Rangers farm team. And he said, I'm not taking you to see Snow White. We're going to go see a hockey game. So I started crying because all I cared about was Snow White, and I didn't know anything about hockey. So my father never gave in to me, so he yanked me into the garden, and I was furious. And when I finished crying, I realized that my father was rooting for the home team, the Rovers, and I couldn't agree with him on that because he took me away from Snow White, so I rooted for the other team, the Washington Eagles, and they had a player. My childhood radio idol was the Lone Ranger and Cowboy. So when I realized my father was rooting for the Rovers, I picked out a guy on the other team named Normie Burns, who looked the way I thought the Lone Ranger would look if he was playing hockey. And this guy scored three goals. Washington won the game, which meant my father lost. And I was feeling very good about it. I liked what I was seeing. It was exciting. So the next day at school, my teacher, Mrs. Gould, called on me to do a thing called show and tell. So I figured I'd do the goalie because he was the guy who fascinated me. And I got an A from doing the goalie. So I figured, well, this hockey isn't too bad after all. He took me to see Snow White the following Saturday. On the subway home, I said, Dad, can we see another hockey game tomorrow? He said yes, and I never stopped going after that.
That's great. Wow. So can you recall, as you get a bit older, a conversation at home when it goes from, I don't just like hockey, I want to work in the world of hockey?
Well, they got a pretty good idea about it as I started to go to the Sunday afternoon games, because I would write in the program where there was a lot of white space. I would write my report on the game. And I started a scrapbook in 1942 on my birthday. My parents gave me a little radio and a scrapbook with a three-dimensional Indian head on it. And I was collecting stories from 42 on from the newspapers. And in 46, when my fan interest in the Maple Leafs had probably tripled by that time, and I began subscribing to a Toronto daily paper called the Globe and Mail, and they could see, you know, I was having these scrapbooks. I was going to the Ranger games. I couldn't go to the Ranger games because they were starting at 8:30. So it wasn't until 46 that I went to all the Ranger home games. I was a season ticket holder, but I rooted for the Leafs. And I was very, very, once I started college, I was intent on getting into hockey. And I went to the president of the Rovers, who was also the president of the Eastern League, Tommy Lockhart. And I said, I'd be glad to write a weekly story for your league about all the teams. And he said, yeah, go ahead and do it. And he started to distribute this stuff. So I got known around the garden, particularly by the Ranger people, who, you know. So the guy who was doing publicity for the Rangers was a Brooklyn guy like me, Herbie Gorin. And in September 1954, he called me up and he says, I'd like you to be my assistant. And I thought I died and gone to heaven. I'm getting paid to do hockey. What kind of? So, of course, and now I had to switch allegiance to the team that was paying me. And that was the turning point. I was now in the business. I was getting paid a weekly salary. I was part of the journalism crew. And that year, that season, catapulted me on my career.
How'd your folks feel about that when it was a done deal? Did they ever try to dissuade you?
No, they never did. If anything, they really didn't know, because I didn't want to tell anybody this was happening until it happened, because it was so dreamy to me. I got the call on one day, and Herbie said, you want to do it? And I said, yes. He said, well, I'll call you back tomorrow. So it wasn't clinched. I didn't say anything to anybody. And then when it came through, I was, I did tell them, and of course they were thrilled. I mean, here I was not only getting hockey out of their hair, I didn't have to do scrapbooks and, fill the living room with paper. Now I'm out of their hair. I'm going to the garden. My basic home from that point on was 7 days a week at the garden. I was getting paid for 5 days, but I went on Saturday and Sunday because I just wanted to be there, and that was it. That was it. I actually, my enthusiasm was pretty obvious, and Frank Boucher was the manager of the team, wonderful, wonderful guy. And in the middle of the season, without anybody telling me anything, he said, I'm going to give you a raise. I went up from $50 to 55, which was, at that time, a wonderful thing. I didn't ask for it. He gave it to me.
That qualifies him as the greatest general manager ever.
Well, he was a lovable guy, and I was crushed when he got fired at the end of the season. It was a terrible, terrible thing. In fact, I had told Herbie that I wanted to come back. In those days, once the season was over, he didn't work anymore. He came back in September. And I told Herbie I was determined to come back. And in the interim, I would say it was around June, I was offered a job to write a column for the New York Journal American, which was Hearst's flagship evening paper. And they had started a Brooklyn Long Island section. And Dave Anderson had previously had done it. Dave was moved up to the regular sports. I took over Dave's. And when I got the offer, I did not like the idea of leaving hockey. I remember I sat down with Herbie at lunch at the Automat on 3rd Avenue and 42nd. And he said, don't be a fool. Don't be a fool. You'll be able to follow hockey, but you should take the job. And of course, it was a great, great opportunity because I wound up able to cover City Hall. I covered entertainment. I covered just about, I had a ski column. I had a skate column. And I had, my regular column now. And when Dave Anderson moved from the Journal American to the Times, I moved into his spot covering the Rangers.
How about the move from writing to television? Was that something that was a smooth transition for you, or did you feel like it was a bit rocky at the beginning?
Well, like I had said earlier with Herbie, I told Herbie I didn't want to leave hockey, and he said to me, "This is a greater horizon for you." You will see. In this case, a friend of mine from Boston who had a radio show, his name was Eddie Andelman, and Eddie called me up and told me that there was an opening to do television of the New England Whalers. They were then in the World Hockey. They were competing with the Bruins. And I said, no, 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 Eddie, I'm in print. And in those days, the print people resented and looked down on TV. There was a very, very mean-spirited rivalry in those days. And I remember newspaper guys pushing cameramen away because of the hatred. There was hatred. Particularly Dick Young of the Daily News was, leading the print guys. So when I got this, Eddie Andelman was, they want somebody to do analysis for the Whaler games. I said, Eddie, next to that, because I love what I'm doing, and forget about it. He says, no, 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 don't forget about it. I want you to think I can get you good money for this. So when he told me the amount of dough, I said, Eddie, you'll never get that from me. He said, well, I'll call you back tomorrow and let you know. He calls me the next day, said, I'm getting you the dough. I said, okay, I'm taking the job. And when I took the job, I didn't know what the hell to do because I was a print guy. It took me a while to really get the feel of TV, but I did, and that was it.
How did it come about that your wife, Shirley, a blessed memory, got into the sport and got into the sport professionally?
Well, when we met, this would have been the summer of 67. And she didn't know anything about hockey. And she didn't really know much about my affection and how involved I was, which it was a good thing. She found out about it later. I took her to a Ranger exhibition game with the Canadians, and she absolutely loved it. She had gone to Michigan University, and she had seen hockey there, but this was totally different. And since she loved it so much, we hooked on in terms of doing a lot of together work. We wrote at least 5 or 6 books together. She was responsible, not me, for the first really major. McMillan did a great baseball encyclopedia, and they asked us to do a hockey version. And it was, she did 90%. She was good with the computers were coming in, and she was really very good at that. And she began writing her own hockey books. I always tell people that she became a better writer than I was, and she was. She was the first woman to crack the gender barrier at Madison Square Garden. They didn't let women in the press box. If you were covering the Rangers, you got a ticket for every single game, and on the ticket in plain English, it said, "Ladies not allowed in the press box." And she got an assignment from a Canadian paper to cover the Rangers' 71 series playoff with the Leafs. And they barred her from working in the press box. She took the case to the New York City Human Rights Commission, and she won, and she was the first lady to work in the press box at the Old Garden.
What was that experience like for you to go through that with her?
Well, it was devastating. I am in error. It was not, this was at the present Garden. It was
right.
It was devastating because all the men on the hockey beat resented her, and I lost a lot of friends. There were only one guy stuck up for her, and that was a young fellow from the Post called Neil Offen, guy who I did a book with, Hal Bach of AP. He was fervently against it. And in a mild sort of way, at the beginning, she was being a little bit on the harassed, made some wide cracks, you know, when she came out of the press room for the first time, two guys are talking. One guy says, "What is that, the coach's wife?" You know, stuff like that. But she did her thing, and she became very good at it.
The notion of books, or the idea of books, you've written one or two. Do you know what the number is up to at this point?
I never counted. I tell you, Bud, I never bothered to count because once a book was done, I was looking ahead to the next one. That's mm-hmm. all that really mattered. Now, I would say, realistically, the number would be between 95 and 102, something like that, because I just have a new one out with two other guys, A 50-Year History of the Islanders. That's just out, and I've written a book about my growing up in Brooklyn, which is not a hockey book, called Tales of Brooklyn. Tales of Brooklyn is one of my favorite things. It's 36 chapters about me from 1937 through 1951, all about living in Brooklyn during World War II, going to Dodgers games. I covered the Dodgers when they won the series in 55. It's all different fun and sad stuff. And Tales of Brooklyn now you can get from Amazon, and I'm very happy with the way the book has gone. It's 36 different chapters. A lot of fun, a lot of sadness.
You mentioned sadness. You had relatives who were killed in the Holocaust. Is that a topic, as you were growing up, that is spoken or unspoken in your home in Brooklyn?
It's basically unspoken until two things happened. I was collecting stamps, and around 1942, we received a letter, because the roots of the family were what's now Slovakia. It was then part of Czechoslovakia, and then it became a rump state of the Nazis called, over there it was called Slovensko. And I had this stamp album, Scott stamp album, nice, very into collecting stamps, and we got a letter from Slovakia, and it said Slovensko on it. There was no no room. There wasn't any listing for that in my stamp album. I didn't know what the heck it was. Well, it turned out we got two letters from relatives there. And then the third one was actually more a postcard from the Red Cross saying that they couldn't be located anymore. And that was the end of it. They, like everybody else, all the Jews in their town. The town was called Nudmihar in Hungarian. I went there in 61, and nobody. There was a synagogue was still left up, but there were they didn't have enough Jews there for a minyan. So we lost our family. We figured around 43. That was the last we heard.
And after that, as you're growing up, that's a topic again that. Your folks would or would not discuss at all at home?
It was discussed mostly out of my hearing. There was a lot of, there wasn't any real news coming out. There was nothing about the ovens. We didn't know, Auschwitz wasn't even mentioned. This only came out at the end. I mean, there were stories that were leaked out, but it didn't get much of a play. We basically had given up on them in terms of survival.
Do you think it had any effect on you in terms of your outlook on life as a young man?
It absolutely, eventually, slowly but surely, turned me into a very avid Zionist, a supporter of Israel. And it grew. It grew on me. I went to my first time in Israel. I went as a journalist after the Six-Day War. And later on, when Simon was grown up, I took him there in 1998 for the first time for 10 days. And he went back. He was working in California at the time. He started to study up. And he moved to Israel in 1999. 2000, he nearly was killed by a car bomb, which went off half a block away. But he escaped physically, but that affected him.
Sometimes in the world of sports, I know from my own experience, we take these games and we make them seem as if they are life or death. Did your experience as a young man and that experience of your family being killed in the Holocaust, did that at times, especially when you're first getting in the business, did that kind of give you a sense of, hey, we're talking about a hockey game here. Let's keep it as that and let's put it, keep it in perspective.
I would like to say that I was able to, but I wasn't. It was the intensity was always there in front of me at the game, and like we were talking about a diversion. But I have always taken the game very seriously. And really what happened 25 years ago when I told Joni that I'm not going to take it that seriously anymore, it didn't happen. And it hasn't happened. And if you were with me in the room last Saturday night watching the Islanders and yelling and screaming, telling them what to do when they weren't doing right, I haven't changed. I'm sorry.
I was, for the record, I was not in the room with you, but I heard you. I heard you all the way from that apartment. It sounds crazy for someone who has been in the hockey world for some 70 years, but was there ever a plan B? Ever something like, you know what, if this doesn't work out, I'd like to be fill in the blank.
I actually had the plan B in mind pretty early. I graduated Brooklyn College in 54. And while I was working at the Journal American newspaper, I always felt, I wasn't locked in here. I didn't know how long I'd be in the business. So I started going for my master's at Long Island University and eventually got my degree. And I taught at Fordham University for 2 years while I was in the, doing TV for the Islanders. And then I taught at Columbia for a year. My wife actually took over for me because my schedule got heavy. And I always felt that I could go into teaching. And I did teach. I actually did in the 2 years at Fordham. A lot of good talent were in my class. Bob Papa, the Giants broadcaster, was in my class. And right now she's Mike Milbury's wife, Ginger Killian. Ginger went on to be the Rangers and Islanders publicist. And a few other really good people went into the business.
Stan, much like Billy Joel can't leave the building without singing Piano Man or Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run, you're not leaving us today until my listeners hear the net story. So for the 147th time, and that's not even enough, what is the net story?
Well, Art Ross, who ran the Bruins, was always inventive, and he invented a better puck by smoothing down the edges so you wouldn't get cut when you got hit with it, or not cut as badly. And he realized that the net in those days was box-like, and very often there was no TV replays. Puck would hit the back of the net and bounce right out, and you couldn't tell whether it went in or not. So he designed a new net which had curves at the bottom so that when the puck went in, it hit the these curves, and then it slid into the thick net. So every time the puck went in, it never bounced out. And it was officially adopted as the Art Ross official NHL net. This was at the start of World War II. Every NHL team had one. At that time, there were seven teams with the New York Americans. It was the kind of thing that any minor league club would want for prestige. You know, now we're using the Art Ross NHL net, and one of the wealthier minor league teams was in Buffalo. And there was a team in Springfield run by the great hockey Bruin hero, Eddie Shore. And Eddie Shore wanted one of those Art Ross nets. Of course, he would have liked to have two. The whole deal was that Eddie Shore in Springfield traded a player to Buffalo, and in return for that player, he got one Art Ross net. So the next day, the guy who was covering the Springfield team for the Springfield Union newspaper, Sam Pompey, goes into Shore's office, and he said, "Eddie, you just traded Joe Blow to Buffalo, and you got one Art Ross net back. Why didn't you get two Art Ross nets?" And he says, "Because," and he slammed the desk, "because he was only worth one Art Ross net." That was the story.
Are you at all reflective about the fact that you had this idea of working in hockey a lifetime ago, and all of a sudden you've been doing it for 70 years?
Well, I always was cautious about my ability to do things the right way. In other words, when I started writing professionally, working on a daily newspaper, I wasn't confident. So I went to NYU at night, and I took four courses over a couple of years. And it was the same thing in TV. I never felt that secure about the TV because, you know, things change, or different producers, and you get different owners. So I never felt secure in TV, for a long time. And that's why I had the plan B, which was teaching. And that's why I did. I actually took the job at Fordham because I felt that I wouldn't have a contract the following year, and this was something to fall back on. So I've never taken it for granted right up to the present. I'm writing differently now at age 92. I like to say I'm actually at 29 years old. But I'm writing lighter and funnier and liking it better at this age. And that's why I say I was 92 Sunday ago, but I turned 29 on Monday, and I'm writing like a 29-year-old.
Stan, it's always a pleasure.
Well, as my father would say, my pleasure is pinochle.
Stan Fischler, the hockey maven. There are tons of Stan Fischler hockey books to read. His book on his youth, Tales of Brooklyn, is available on Amazon. And there are books like The Subway and the City about Fischler's other passion, the New York transit system. Before the Cheering Started is a production of June 14th Productions. This episode was created and written by me. Guitar playing, that's me as well. No extra charge. I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is Before the Cheering Started. Thanks for joining us on the journey.